नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमद्भक्तवेदान्तस्वामिनिति नाम्ने नमस्ते सरस्वतीदेवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशचारिणे श्रीकृष्णचैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसृति गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे John Bob and Candle 7, Chapter 13, Verse 36.
Viraga Savaka Mebhya.
Viraga Savaka Mebhya.
Sikshato Me Madhuvrata.
Sikshato Me Madhuvrata.
Prachaptam Madhuvatvitam.
Prachaptam Madhuvatvitam.
Advapanyo Harepatim.
Advapanyo Harepatim.
Translation from the Mumblebee, I have learned to be unattached to accumulating money. For although money is as good as honey, anyone can kill its owner and take it away. Purport, the honey gathered in the comb is taken away by force. Therefore, one who accumulates money should realize that he may be harassed by the government or by thieves or even killed by enemies, especially in this age of Kali. It is said that instead of protecting the money of the citizens, the government itself will take away the money with the force of law. The learned Brahmana had therefore decided that he should not accumulate any money. One should own as much as he immediately needs. There is no need to keep a big balance in hand, although with the fear that it may be plundered, along with the fear that it may be plundered by the government or by thieves. Translation from the Bumblebee, I've learned to be unattached to accumulating money, for although the money is as good as honey, anyone can kill its owner and take it away. So, this is an example used to live very simply and not accumulate unnecessary money. He gives the example here of the bee. The bee produces honey, but then the honey gets taken away because everyone likes to eat the honey. Well, human bees like to eat it, the bears like to eat it, the ants like to eat it. So bee produces all the stuff and stores it up for its children, a larva or whatever, and then somebody goes and takes it all away. So, in the same way as human beings, we can accumulate money, which is like the honey. And what do you get the honey for anyway? Why do we need honey? Because you want to enjoy it somehow. You want to use it for something. So the bees use it to store it up as food for their larva. And human beings accumulate money because they also want to use it for something. They can use it for their family, raise their family, and they can use it for themselves for some enjoyment of some sort. So whether there's money or honey, nevertheless it comes around to getting some enjoyment. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and recreation. These things. So in this way we accumulate money. But like the bumblebee accumulates and then somebody sees all that honey and says, why can't I have some too? Because look at how much the bee's got. He doesn't need all that honey. So in the same way, you get all your money, and then someone will say, look, you got all that money, I'm going to take some away. So the government takes some, definitely, they take away in taxes, they take away some of your money. I don't know how much percent, maybe 25% or whatever, 30% ultimately gets taken away from you by government. Yeah, and the richer you are, the more they take. And then thieves will come, and they will try to steal your money also. The thieves will say, well, you got all this money, why can't I have some? You know? You got too much money, you don't need it. I can take some. So that's the thief's rationale. And there's cheaters out there. look, he's got all that money, so we'll cheat him out of his money. Because you have it, they want to get easy money, so they'll try to cheat you out of your money. Huh? And then if you have money, then your family members and your friends and everyone else will come around and say, he's got money, and then they'll try to get things off you. So in this way, it is therefore not so advisable to have so much money, because you have to worry about keeping it then. People will take it all away from you when you have it. So this is the big anxiety of accumulating in the material world. Nevertheless, that accumulation is there. Accumulation of money is one thing. It's symptomatic of something else also. We know in the story of Parikshit and Kali, personification of Kali, Parikshit said the personification of Kali beating the bull, breaking his legs, and the cow was there weeping, and that was the earth, and Dharma was the bull. And then Parikshit Maharaj got very angry with Kali and said, I will kill you, and got his sword out ready to kill him. And then Kali said, no, just give me somewhere to live. And so Parikshit gave him places to live where there were the four sinful activities, plus where there was hoarding of money. Because where you get hoarding of money, then you get these four things also. What do we use the extra money for? You use it for those sinful activities. This is the usual way which people use this money. Waste it away in some way or other. For their pleasure. So, of course, if we like enjoying in this material world with our body, we've got to get some enjoyment. Then you can take limited enjoyment, which is allowed by Dharma. There's some enjoyment in Varnashram system. But then again, the tendency is when you get some enjoyment, and especially if you've got money, then you want to get more enjoyment. There's more opportunities for enjoyment with that money. So you want to get more enjoyment, more types of enjoyment. And that is the big danger. Therefore, it becomes irregular enjoyment. And then it becomes sinful enjoyment. And becomes these sinful activities. So in this way, we involve ourselves in sinful activities, and then we end up with a lot of suffering in the material world. We suffer. Other people suffer. We get karma. And we wander around in ignorance in this material world, birth after birth. This is the hoarding money is one symptom of the desire to get enjoyment in the material world. And that enjoyment is not only for the human being, it is there for all living entities, whether it's plant or animal. They get some enjoyment. And that is why they're in this material world. With the material body, because they're trying to get enjoyment. We try to get enjoyment by our doing activities in this material world. And we have our senses, and we have our knowledge gathering senses and our action senses, karmendriya and jnanendriya, five of each. So we have our jnanendriya to perceive the world, to look for the enjoyment. Knowledge of enjoyment. Once you get the knowledge of enjoyment, then you got to get the enjoyment. So therefore you use your karmendriyas to get the enjoyment. And then with all your senses you can enjoy once you get it. So this is the and then of course we're not free. As animals, of course, you are free. Because your enjoyment also is limited in certain ways, because you're not very intelligent. But the human being is a very special animal because of his intelligence. And therefore, his enjoyment is not so limited as the animals. It takes on all diverse forms because of that. So this is a great temptation for the human being. We don't have to have Dharma for the animals and tell them what to do and what not to do. We don't have governments to keep them under control and keep them from stealing and lying and all this. Animals don't have all this. They don't have to go to school to get morality taught to them. They don't have laws enforcing them to be upright citizens. They naturally follow whatever they have to follow, and they don't really go beyond that. We don't find criminal animals, really.
What they do usually is out of necessity, whether it's the lion or whether it's the giraffe or the, you know, alligator or whatever. They just do it out of necessity, usually. Maybe the shark is a little special. But most animals just do out of necessity because they're hungry. They have to bite somewhere. And they don't usually attack unnecessarily unless they've been aggravated in some way, you know. And they don't overdo things. They have a certain mating season, that's what. And they have a certain amount of food they eat, and that's it. They don't overeat. And unless they're in captivity and under natural, unnatural circumstances, they don't do anything really extreme. Yeah? And they don't unnecessarily kill their own species. Yeah? They're trying to make their species survive, so they don't really kill their own species. They may kill other animals who are interfering with them, but they don't kill their own species. They don't become lazy. Lazy, it's no lazy animals. They do what they have to do to survive. When we come to the human being, he's intelligent and he can do many things with his life, and he gets time to relax and do many things. And he has opportunity for more types of enjoyment. His sex life, he can have any time of the year. He can eat as much as he wants, any type of food he wants. So we see the human being overeats usually. We don't see that much in animals. They don't do that. But we see human being very, very common tendency. Most developed, the more developed the country comes, the more they overeat. Yeah, everyone in America thinks it's overweight. Yeah? Everybody overweight. Yeah? Of course, it's not good for the body or anything. But nevertheless, the enjoyment tendency is there, so therefore you just start eating. Because you have the facility, you got the money to buy the food, so you eat, eat, eat. This is how you do. Not necessary. Overweight means not necessary. Yeah? But nevertheless, the money is there, and you like to eat, so therefore you do it. You waste your money unnecessarily for the food. We go out and work, we get the money, and then we use it for that unnecessarily. That's an over-endeavor. And, of course, eating, sleeping, of course, mating and defending. We need house or some sort, some shelter for defense and for sleeping, etc. And then again, we can spend our whole life trying to buy a house, build a house, or make a house according to our own desires and likes and dislikes, whatever. So we can just sacrifice our whole life for that. Whereas animals, they live very simply, a very simple shelter and sleep, etc. And defending, of course, houses for defense and whatnot, so to keep the thieves out. And the more money you got, then the more security you have to have to keep the thieves out. And then we need the country to protect us from other countries. So we have to have the countries have to have their defense system also to keep the other countries away. And then the country has to tax you for the defense of the country. So then, I don't know how much percent America, maybe 30% of the budget goes for that. Or I don't know, maybe 80% of the budget goes for defense. It's an enormous amount of money that goes for defense anyway. Maybe 80% or something it was. And 90% is a terrible amount of money. And where does the money come from? It comes from the people. They get taxed. So you're working in order to get that defense for your country. So you're working, let's say, 3 or 4 hours a day is spent in defense of the country, and maybe another 3 hours for the defense of your house or whatever like this, or you're making your house and protection and all that. Spend money, a lot of money on defense. A lot of our time and energy goes to this. So we have, you know, maybe 80, 90, 100 years in our life. First 5 years is, you can cut that up because you just play around. And the last 10 years, maybe retired, 20 years retirement, so you don't do anything there either. So then you got the middle years, maybe 60 years. And of those 60 years, you spend 20 years getting educated so you can get a job. And simply to get a job, the education is simply to get a job. And then you spend the next, you know, 40 years working at that job, 8 hours a day. And what do? You get money. Let's say honey. And what do you do with it? You save it up and you get people to take it away. or you spend it yourself. And either whether you spend it or someone else takes it away, it's all for enjoyment. Somebody's going to use it for enjoyment. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending.
So you use your money for your house and for your car and for your food and for supporting your family, educating your family, etc. Huh? So the basic ease that you can make in depending. Huh? Most of your energy all day long goes to this for most of your life. Huh? That's the 8 hours a day, is one quarter of the day, and then multiplied by two because you sleep the other half of the day. That's 16 hours right there. Huh? No, that's one third of the day, two-thirds of the day. Huh? Working so you can get your eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and then the other part sleeping. Huh? So there's 6 hours left for something to do, in which you have to eat and do other things. Eat and get your sense gratification. So there's not much time left, actually, for your enjoyment part, let's say. The working is not the enjoyment. The working is only to get the money so you can enjoy. And your whole education, everything, 20 years goes for all this, you know, to get that enjoyment. So we may waste most of the life. We're trying to get the honey, the money for the enjoyment, but most of the time we spend working for that. And then a lot of that's spent on eating, sleeping, and mating, and defending. And you don't even have any free time to enjoy. So the human being is very special like this. He's got a very special way in which he spends his time up. Sure. But animals don't do that, you know. They got time to sit there because they just, you know, eating and sleeping, mating, defending is minimized to some degree. Huh? But human beings somehow makes it very elaborate. And we go to extremes also, as I said, all these things become extreme. The defense is extreme, and the mating is extreme, and the eating is extreme. I mean, the sleeping also is extreme. So in this way, the human being has got a very risky type of body, existence, birth, because he can waste it unnecessarily, more than animals even, and go to extremes. And when it goes to extremes, then it is called sinful activity. There's no extreme for the animal, so there's no sinful activity. For the human being, we have our intelligence, and using that intelligence in pursuit of the desires in the mind, then we can go to extremes, and then it becomes sinful activity. We do what we do. It's not necessary, but we do it anyway for our pleasure. And so that is called sinful activity. Because if we get the problem in the material world is our enjoyment is every living entity is related to some other living entity ultimately. And for our enjoyment, it means suffering for somebody else. Somewhere along the line, for our enjoyment, it means suffering somewhere. And we cannot escape that in the material world. So the more enjoyment I try to get, the more suffering I also cause. It's a funny, peculiar nature of the material world. Krishna's made it like that. And so what this produces is karma, because we're supposed to be responsible for our activities also as a human being. We have the freedom to choose our activities. Yes, how much I want to enjoy. I can choose that as a human being. Huh? So some people say that's the good advantage of a human being. He's so intelligent, he can get more enjoyment than the animals. Huh? We can do more, get more types of enjoyment than the animals, and some people think that's the whole advantage of the human being. Huh? So therefore we get this type of what we call hedonistic materialism, where one simply tries to enjoy as much as possible in this lifetime. Huh? And that of course is the worst position, that's the Charvaka philosophy. There's nothing except the material body in this world, so therefore enjoy. Enjoyment is the goal of life, and therefore let us enjoy as much as we can. Charvaka is not a myth, he was a serious philosopher. He wrote his book, his own little authoritative book on how you should enjoy, why you should enjoy, and how you should enjoy in this material world. And people were reading this seriously sometime in India also. But we see it's actually a philosophy in the material world, and the Western world also. Some people are into that. They may not, you know, think about it too much, but nevertheless this is what they do. That's their philosophy of life. So that's the possibility that we can enjoy as much as possible. And on the other hand, if we're intelligent, then we will realize that our enjoyment is at somebody else's expense, and that's not such a good thing. But if we don't, then there's an inbuilt mechanism to make us learn, and that is the mechanism of karma. For the human being, we have the free will to get as much enjoyment as we want, but we also got responsibility for that enjoyment. If you want to enjoy, then you have to suffer also. Because you're causing suffering to others for your enjoyment. Therefore, you should also suffer. Just like in the country, if you steal something from somebody else, the other person worked to get something and you steal it. Then you have to get a reaction for that. So the government will catch you and they will punish you because you interfered with that person and gave him misery because of stealing something. Therefore, government will inflict some equal suffering upon you. As much as he got his suffering, then you get the suffering back. So this is, you know, in justice, in the human mind, we think that, you know, if the suffering is caused by somebody, he should get the equal amount of suffering back. Somehow he has to pay for it, somehow or other. And that's what happens in karma. You also get the suffering back. You do you get your enjoyment, you cause the suffering, so therefore you get equal amount of suffering back. So if you get more, you try to enjoy more, and you interfere with more living entities and cause them suffering, then you'll get equal suffering back. Yeah. So some types of enjoyment, you don't get there's no problem in that, and there's a way of getting around this also, but most people, if they try to get enjoyment as much as possible, then they do cause suffering to other living entities, therefore they have to suffer for that. So it's a simple law. Of course, the idea behind the law is not simply to cause people suffering. That's not the whole idea. An eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. It's not simply to take revenge as such. It is definitely justice, and that should happen like that. But that's not the whole point. The whole point for Krishna, at least, is that we should rectify ourselves and correct our actions. And that, of course, is what the government is there for also, to correct the criminals. They're trying to correct them by, you know, saying that, and see, this is what you get. If you do this, this is the reaction. So therefore, don't do it anymore. But generally, we don't learn except by experiencing the suffering. A lot of people, of course, don't go to jail. They don't steal, they don't go to jail, because probably in the past they've learned their lessons already. Some people steal, and then they have to suffer for that. Now, if they get the whole thing enough, well, hopefully they will learn from that experience not to steal anymore. That's the whole intention. Some people don't even after that. So it's the same with karma. Some people learn, some people don't learn. They get the reaction, they suffer, and then they do the same activity again. They go out and try to get the same enjoyment. I'm suffering so much, I must get that enjoyment, therefore I'll do what I did before and I'll get that enjoyment again. And again they get more suffering because of that. So you can repeat this process over and over, and that's what we do. That's why we're in the material world for billions and billions of lifetimes. Because we don't learn very quickly. Nevertheless, after so many experiences, then we may, if we're a little intelligent, get the clue that something is happening here, and that my activities also give reactions like this, so therefore I have to be very responsible for my actions, very carefully judge them. See what is happening. So this is actually what Krishna wants us to do. He wants us to learn to be responsible for our actions in this world. And when we do that, then we begin acting on a higher level. That is, we're acting on the sattvagun level, actually. And when we do this, we minimize our sense of enjoyment. Because necessarily, the more you try to enjoy, then the more sin you commit, and then the more reactions you get. So the less you try to enjoy, the more regulated your enjoyment is, then the less you have to suffer. That's natural. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you can, the other secret is that if you do punyas, then you can not only get not suffering, but you can get enjoyment. So by giving, instead of enjoying, instead of taking, you give, then you get giving in your next lifetime. If you give, then you get, somebody gives to you. If you give to other people in this lifetime, people give to you in your next lifetime. In other words, you get benefits in your next lifetime without asking for them. If you give to other people in this lifetime. Just as you take, then it gets taken from you in the next lifetime. So it's this is what we call papa and punya. Which leads to papa leads to suffering, and punya leads to enjoyment in this material world. So these are the two things.
So one who is in the mode of goodness, then he does punyas, and he minimizes his the sense enjoyment. The sense enjoyment is restricted, and he does punyas. He does acts of goodness to other people. That's not the final level that Krishna wants, but it's one level of existence which is more peaceful than the other lower levels of life. So therefore, ultimately we give up that sense of enjoyment. And that's what is spoken of here, that one should learn from the bee, not to accumulate money, not to strive for more and more enjoyment in this material world. We have to come to that level. And because when we try to accumulate money for enjoyment, then we have to suffer for it. We get it, but then there's so many anxieties attached to it. He doesn't mention the karma part of it, but nevertheless, that's also there. We get the money, we try to enjoy, we get the karma. And when we get the money, then there's already problems because it's going to get taken away also. And even if nobody takes it away and you've got enough security to keep it all of your life, nevertheless, when you die, it gets taken away. And when you're dead, you can't take any of it. You realize you can't take any of it with you. And if you dedicated your life to making money, and when you die, you'll realize that my life is wasted because I can't take it with me. I can't enjoy it. It's gone. And you can't get that money back in the next lifetime. You have to start all over and work again in the next lifetime to get the money. So it's a big endeavor for what? So not only the money, for the enjoyment. When you get your enjoyment in this material world, you strive for your goal, and your goal is to get enjoyment in this world. When you die, what happens to the enjoyment is also gone. Because that body you had to get the enjoyment is also finished. You cannot take it with you. Then you have to start all over in your next lifetime. So it's a very frustrating experience. Through this frustration, then the jiva has to get a little intelligence. This is the whole purpose of Krishna, to frustrate us in the material world so that we'll get some intelligence to realize that we don't belong in the material world at all. It's an unnatural situation. We don't belong here. So that's what he wants us to learn. In the Mahabharata, there's a story, maybe I told the story before, but anyway, it's about the honey also. And that's the story of the Brahmana. The Brahmana was wandering in the desert, and then he found himself in the desert. Didn't know how he got there, but he was wandering in the desert, and he was suffering because he had no food, and no very hot, no water. Didn't know what to do, didn't know where he was. Then in the distance he saw a big forest, so he became very excited. And then he thought, now I'll get some water, now I get some food, now I get some shade. So he ran towards the forest. And when he got to the forest, he found it had a big wall around it. Huge, high wall. And then he thought, well, I have to get in. So he went looking for the gate. And he walked and walked and walked. There was no gate to this forest. No, the wall was continuous. It went on to a huge forest. And there's a big wall around it. Like, he walked and walked, but there was no end to that wall. So he was so anxious to get into that forest that to get his enjoyment that he decided he'd climb the wall. It was very difficult to climb, but somehow or other he managed to put his feet in and scale that high wall with great difficulty. And he got to the top of the wall, and then he lowered himself inside. The nature of the wall was such that you could climb up it with great difficulty. When you got to the other side, you could not climb out. It was even more difficult to get out than to get in. So he couldn't climb out. But he made the decision, it's better to be inside than outside, because there's a forest here at least, and it's a nice place to get my food. So anyway, he ended up in the forest, and he thought, now I'll get my enjoyment in this forest. But he realized when he got down there in the forest and put his feet on the ground that there were wild animals in the forest. There was bears and tigers and snakes and scorpions and wolves and all sorts of creatures that were very hungry. And all these creatures began to chase him. And they just ran after him, and he had to run. And he had to run and run. And the animals were very quick also. And they would bite him once in a while. They would run and they would bite. And then he had to run harder. And then they would catch up to him and they would bite him again. And he would have to run. And run, run, run like this through the forest. And it was very difficult for him, and he was getting tired. Then he saw in front of him suddenly this huge Rakshasi appeared with a fierce eyes and big teeth and big nails. And she began chasing him also. And he didn't know what to do. So he was running through the forest trying to get away from all these creatures. And it was all tangled up with vines and thorns and things cutting his skin, and he was bleeding. He was going through the forest like this, trying to escape these animals. And then he tripped and fell and caught his foot on some vine that was on the earth like that, and he fell over. And then he thought, now the animals are going to eat me up. And he was very afraid. He closed his eyes. And then a second later, he opened his eyes and he found that he wasn't eaten up. Rather, he was hanging over a big blind well, and his foot got caught in a vine that was hanging from a tree above, a branch of a tree, like this, and he was hanging over a well, upside down, with his feet up and his head down, like that. And the animals were at the edge of the well, but they were trying to bite him, but they couldn't reach, you know? So then he was saved. But he was over this well, hanging over this big well, and the well was very deep, and he was looking down into the well, a very, very deep well, and the walls were very steep. If he fell in the well, he could not climb up. And at the bottom of the well, there was no water. So if he fell, then he'd break his head on the rocks at the bottom. Huh? And then he looked down there, and there was a big snake sitting at the bottom of the well. The snake was waiting for some food. So it was looking at this man dangling up there, waiting for him to fall in. So therefore the man thought, I can't go down in the well, because I'll never get out, the snake's going to eat me up. Then he thought, well, somehow or other I should climb in the tree, maybe. So he looked upwards, where his feet were tangled in the vine was hanging from the tree. And then he noticed in the tree there was a lot of rats in the tree, black rats and white rats, and they were nibbling on the vine that was holding his foot up. They chew everything up and nibble them. So they were chewing away at the vine that was holding his foot up. The black white rats would nibble, and when they got tired, then the white rats would nibble, and they were nibbling away like this. And the vine was getting thinner and thinner and thinner as a result of this. And if he moved a little too much, then he would probably break the vine and it would fall into the pit, and the snake would devour him. So it was very difficult for him to struggle to get up in the tree also, because the white rats were up there nibbling away like this. So he was trapped, and he didn't know what to do. And moreover, in the tree there was a beehive. And because he was, swaying back and forth from this vine, it moved the beehive, and the bees got very angry. So the bees came out of the beehive, and they started stinging him all over his body. And it hurt. And he had to, try to avoid them. But if he moved more, then more bees would come out and sting him all over the body. And that's why he was full of pain. And he was trapped. He couldn't go up, he couldn't go down, he couldn't go to the sides. The animals were at the sides, and the rakshasi was there, and the rats were nibbling at the top, and the snake was waiting at the bottom. And nevertheless, he was smiling. He was smiling after all this. So the reason he was smiling was because he was upside down like this, in this very miserable condition, full of pain, and he couldn't escape, and death was inevitable. Because sooner or later the rats would nibble through and he'd fall and things. And he's smiling. But why was he smiling? Because from the beehive, every now and then, a little drop of honey would fall, and it would fall right in his mouth. And then he would taste the honey, and he would think, oh, it's so nice, this honey. When is the next drop going to fall? And he was very peaceful because of this. So the symbol is an allegory, like the Puranjana allegory. So the Brahmana is the jiva, and this walled forest is the universe, material universe with its covering. Once you're in, you cannot get out. Very difficult to get out. And what do you come into the universe for? To get your enjoyment. But when you try to get your enjoyment, there's some problems there. We have all sorts of sicknesses, all sorts of harassments in life. There's like animals biting. We get old age, ultimately, which decreases your ability to enjoy. That's the big rakshasi, jara, waiting. The hanging upside down, of course, in the well is like getting a material body. And the vine holding you up is your lifespan, the number of years you have to live. And the black and white rats are days and nights. And as each day and night passes, the lifespan gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, like that.
the vine becomes thinner and thinner. And the snake at the bottom is death. So when your lifespan is finished and the rats finish nibbling away at the vine, then you fall into the well and the snake devours you, death devours you. You're finished. And the honey, of course, is what keeps us tolerating the situation where we have death in front of us, all of the afflictions of life and problems in life, and a decreasing lifespan every day, every minute. But why do we tolerate this situation? And because we get our happiness. And how do we get our happiness? From the honey. Some enjoyment we get in this material world, and that blinds us to the fact that we're inevitably going to have to give it up and drop into the well. The time is going like this, tick, 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 and sooner or later you're going to fall into the well. Nevertheless, you smile. You get your honey, then you don't mind so much. And you tolerate that. Okay, life is short, but nevertheless, we get our enjoyment here, so that's enough. So this is the situation in the world. We're hanging upside down, and the rats are nibbling at the vine, and the snake is waiting there, and all the animals are biting you, and all this, and the bees are biting. To get that enjoyment, to get the honey, you have to tolerate suffering. You have to work. You have to do so many things to get your money. And put so much energy into it. It depletes your body. And the biting of the bees. Nevertheless, we tolerate because we get the honey. So this is the symbol of man in the material world trying to enjoy. He enjoys, but he also has to take so much suffering with it. So many conditions are there. So this is the illusion of material life. And this desire to get that enjoyment keeps us in the material world. Kama. And this is what keeps us in the material world. And Narada Muni here is, Nasa Brahman here is teaching that one should become detached from sarva kama, kame bhya, from all material desires. From all desires, one has to get detachment. So don't be like the bee, getting his money and his honey, and then it gets all taken away finally. And then you do this repeatedly in the material world, birth after birth. So this is our problem. And the solution is, of course, to become detached, as I said here, viraga is detachment. But the only way we become detached, there's no possibility of detachment, because we have to get our enjoyment. And it's very strong in the jiva, that desire for enjoyment. Now, the one way of doing it, of course, is in jnana and renunciation. That's a very difficult process and not very practical for everyone. And it makes the heart very hard also. It's not a recommended process. The process that is advised is to not give up the enjoyment and not obliterate ananda, but rather to transfer the mode of getting the enjoyment. And putting the center not on the self, but on Krishna, on the Supreme Lord. So that means we transform kama into prema. In kama, I am the center of enjoyment. I want to take the honey. And in prema, we give the enjoyment to Krishna. We give him everything instead of taking for ourselves. So Krishna is the center there. Supreme Lord is the center. But in the process of doing that, we get our honey, we get an ananda, we get the enjoyment also. So in this way, because the nature of the jiva is to get that experience of ananda, it's constitutional to the jiva. And if he's not going to get that, then he'll try to get it in the material world. So even if you get to Brahman state, it's not satisfying because you want to do something and get ananda. So therefore, you need to come back to the material world to get mercy of devotees and you advance from that stage. So the only way we can get to the higher stage is by complete surrender of our desires in favor of the Supreme Lord's desires and perform devotion to him. This way we get rid of kama and it's transformed into prema and we get an experience of bliss. So we get the honey after all. And all the forms, Krishna is madhurya. He is the sweetest. He's got the most sweetness in him. So, any question there?
That story about the Brahman reminds me, there's a famous song that there's a musical called The Sound of Music.
Uh-huh.
Which is the most popular musical ever.
Yeah.
And there was a famous song called My Favorite Things, and there's one of the linemen that the chorus was, when the bough breaks, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling bad, I simply remember my favorite things and now I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, that's the material world. Yeah. That's the solution to your suffering in the material world. You think all the nice things to counteract the bad things.
Yeah.
And then we tolerate it. It's a stopgap solution for our material existence. But it happens birth after birth after birth. And sooner or later you must get tired of it. And then you have to think of something else. Taking initiation means that, of course, it's a vow, a promise or a contract. A contract. Just like if you work for somebody in employment, then it's a contract they sign, that I work so many hours a day and I do this is expected of me. And then they make their part of the contract is they give you certain privileges like money and holidays and whatever, on their part. So this contract is two-way. You do something, other person does something. So the idea of initiation or diksha is also like that, in which there's a contract made between spiritual master and the disciple. Now the spiritual master's contract is that he will give knowledge by which you can advance and get yourself out of this material world and attain Krishna. He gives that. That's his part of the contract. Give guidance for that. Give teaching for that. And the student has his duty to perform also. That is, he has to follow those instructions. He has to be serious, first of all. His qualification is that he should be serious for that goal. Why go to the spiritual master if you're not serious about getting what he's offering? So one has to be serious about it, first of all. That's the qualification.
You've done that, but then you realize you're maybe not serious,
Oh. Yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem if we're not serious after all. In other words, faith is the qualification for devotional service. Faith. Faith means we have some little inclination towards Krishna, sincere inclination towards Krishna. At a certain point, if it becomes strong enough that we can uphold the vows, then we are ready for initiation. When that faith is not strong enough, then we should not do that. If it's not, it's wavering, then we should not come to that position. So there's some qualification for diksha. Faith is one, and the next, of course, it should be strong enough that we can uphold the contract. And of course, the contract is that he gives that, then you do things. You have regulated principles to follow. You have rules and regulations to follow, chanting and whatever, chanting 16 rounds, etc. All these things are your part of the contract as disciple. So if we can't do those things, then we shouldn't, fake it and say we can do them when we can't do them. So once we take initiation, of course, then it's a problem. Just like in a company, they find out later on you can't do the work. What are they going to do? And they have a contract. So nobody benefits from that contract in one sense. You don't benefit because they don't really want you there because you're a drag in the company and they're giving you money but they can't do it. They don't want you there. And you also feel uncomfortable there also, because you can't really do the work properly that they expected of you. And you're not up to expectations. So it's disadvantage for both parties. So the same also, if one is not qualified by proper interest and seriousness and determination and cannot follow properly, then it's a problem for both. It's a burden on the spiritual master because he took the responsibility, and it's a problem for the person because he can't really do what he was supposed to do and make that promise. So
what's the answer to that? Do you go out and start experiencing the material world again, get hit
Well, that's one way of doing it, yeah. Yeah, if one is not ready, one prematurely did that, fine, then one can do that. The other thing is that if one does have, one has the desires, but still one has determination to follow,
then one could stick to the process and keep doing it in spite of the fact that the desires are there and keep them under control. That's the other thing. If one cannot control them, one can go out in the material world and try again and then again suffer and whatever. Now, the process of devotional service itself is such that it does purify us of karmas and desires, etc. It removes the obstacles in the process itself. So that's one advantage of the process, that if we do stick to it, then we can do that. Now, of course, one of the things is that if we prematurely do this and we're not qualified, then we have to step back again. It's not such a good thing. But then it may be inevitable anyway. It happens. It happens ultimately. So what to do? So then one simply has to accept the fact one's on a lower level, and then on that level, keep trying to come up with a higher level again. At least that much should be there.
If you've kind of been, if you've kind of gone out, if you still keep chanting, you know, but you go through a whole lot of simple things, you know, like trying to learn controlling senses, things like that. You haven't got the knowledge that you've got the chanting, and that's giving you the power that you're going to issue with everything, because you haven't got the knowledge to have the power. So then, do you accrue a lot of simple reactions to what you've been doing?
Well, if one honestly recognizes one's unqualified state, and at least sincerely tries to perform devotional service, whatever extent they can, and keeps trying to come up to the standard, at least that's some advantage, so one gets benefit from that. The problem comes when aparata is involved, and then that's the serious, where we use devotional service to get our enjoyment and our sinful activities, whatever. We use the devotional service itself to support our committing sinful activities in the strength of the holy name. So then it becomes aparad. That's dangerous. We know that anyone can perform some devotional service and get benefit from it, even the most sinful person. But in the process of doing that, then we have to start restricting, you know, as time goes on. We can't just say, well, I'm a devotee, so I can do my sinful activities as much as I want. You know? We have to make some sincere attempt to also restrict. And if we can progress in that direction of restricting more, then of course that's some progress.
Does the spiritual master suffer from the misadventures of his disciples?
In Hari Bhaktivilasa makes a statement like this, that this is in relation to the fact it says that spiritual master should not take many disciples. So therefore, just as the minister, a king for his ministers, and the husband for the wife, so the Purohit for his students, they have to accept the sinful responsibility for the sins of their citizen, protecting person, like that. In other words, the person is in charge of these people, so there's some little bit of sharing, not complete, obviously, because everyone's an individual. We do get our karmas. It's not that it takes all of our karmas, but there is some sharing, obviously, in effects, because we're responsible. Just like the parents for the children. Parents are responsible for the children. The children go out when they're young and they break somebody's window, they throw a stone in somebody's window. They'll go to the parents and take the children to the parents and blame the parents for all this. Yeah? And the parents are going to have to pay for it. And then they have to train the children up again not to do that. So, like that. So the parents get some of the results of their children's upbringing. And if they don't raise their children properly and children come out and they're adult and they're irresponsible, then parents get some sinful reaction for that, obviously, because they're responsible for them.
Even mental pain would be part of that. You know, lamenting that I didn't bring up my children properly.
And guilt or whatever, all these things, all these other reactions take place in the human being and cause suffering. And it looks as if there is some actual responsibility for the karma, just like the king for his citizens. For that sinful activity they commit, he takes 1/6 of it. So it's hard to see how that works, but nevertheless, there's some sharing there. So the suffering is not completely, because the responsibility is there that they shouldn't suffer, they shouldn't sin, and the king is not doing his duty in doing that. Therefore, there's complicity, let's say, in the sinful act. He should make the rules and enforce the rules so they don't have the freedom to commit the sin. If they do, then he's responsible, so he's a sinner also. So the parents are sinful also because they don't raise the children properly. So they get some reaction that way because they're sinful.
So then they get caught in a family where they don't get raised properly either, probably, in the future. They get neglected by their parents as a result of that. And that then they get a problem. They get some suffering also.
So say the spiritual master has disciples, and the spiritual master goes back to
What happens? Yeah, if he's in the spiritual world and you're still in the material world, it doesn't really matter where the spiritual master is once he's departed from his present body. How does he influence you?
Yeah.
Obviously, there must be an influence. Because this is not it's a spiritual thing. It's not a material thing. And both spirit souls are eternal. And whether the spirit soul, the spiritual master, is still in the material world somewhere in some other universe or in this universe in whatever body, or he's in the spiritual world, it doesn't matter. Once that link is established, it's there. Even in the material world, there's links established like this. So that's why people come back and birth after birth in different relationships, because they've established relationships and they find each other out and they meet together in the next lifetime because of this. They say it's like this, you have chakras and everything. And then if you're greatly attached to a person, you establish a very strong string, so to speak, a little wire, a little connection of subtle energy between that person. And it's very hard to break that, especially husband and wife. And so when it's a divorce or something and they rip the whole thing out, then your whole subtle body gets ripped apart, and the heart chakra gets ripped open in the process, and you're not very wounded by that, and you cut like that. Anyway, if there's affectionate relationships, they'll keep together, and even if you're in different, you go into different bodies and everything, nevertheless, over distance, these things operate anyway. Right? And therefore, there's, so that's material, of course. See, the mind is a very funny thing because it doesn't operate like the normal physical laws. They did experiments like with the moving an object, you press a button, make a ball fall, and it can go left or right. Okay? So there's no way of forcibly doing it. All thing you do is think about it, and that's only influences it. So they did the experiments like that, and they found out that the mind does influence the ball to fly out of the right, and say fall to the right, fall to the right. After 2,000 tries, you get a significant portion going, not everyone, but a certain percentage over the chance thing of 50-50. There's a significant amount going according to what the mind says. Yeah? So that way they discovered the mind is a force, or generates a force, and a force on the real world. Therefore, it's a real thing. Thought is a real force. It's a real object. As real as this thought. But then they discovered that it works over distance without any problem. You can do the experiment in New York and have the person sitting in London thinking about it to make the ball fall, and it works with the same effect. Over 3,000 miles, or over 10,000 miles. It doesn't really matter. So the mind somehow can influence over very, very great distance. Very, very powerful. And over time also. They could do an experiment next week and think about it now. Next week when they do the experiment, the balls will fall to the right, and it still works. So the mind has got very great powers, and so therefore there are connections even in the material world over time and space and everything, and different people in their subtle bodies, because their subtle body is their mind, and your mind here. So great connections are there. We don't realize them, but they're nevertheless there. So the spirit soul, of course, is even more powerful, and also beyond time and space. So therefore the connections can be there with the spiritual master wherever he is, and that person. In other words, that contract is not simply a formal contract, but it's some sort of relationship between the souls taking place. So that can extend over time and space. Doesn't matter where they are.
When chanting, is it better to concentrate and actually hear your mantra rather than meditating in the deity?
Meditating
in the
deity? Well, both are there. In other words, all devotional processes are for remembering Krishna and not forgetting him. Yes? So we can concentrate on the mantra, but if we don't think of Krishna in the process, I think we'll lose everything else. Now, the wonderful thing about the name, of course, is you concentrate on the name. Through hearing the name, the name is absolute. So there is a revelation in the name, if one has devotion and some knowledge. Through the name, Krishna's form is revealed. And as one progresses, form is revealed, qualities are revealed, and lila are revealed.
the chanting of the holy name, because the absolute is not different from Krishna. So Prabhupada says the perfect stage of chanting is when you realize Krishna in the holy name. The form, qualities, activities, rasa, everything is in the name. So simply saying Krishna's name is equal to Krishna. That's the final stage. For our stage, we begin with the hearing process, speaking and hearing. But through that, one should develop realization of Krishna, and that is form and everything. So therefore, when we do chant, there's nothing wrong with thinking of Krishna when we chant, because obviously Krishna means it's not just the sound. It's associated with Krishna, the one we know. If you're chanting Hare Krishna, we're thinking of Krishna means something material, then of course we're off track. That's why we have what are called aparads. And we shouldn't think that Krishna is a devata or the process is material. We have to have right philosophical knowledge also when we perform devotional service, otherwise we can think the wrong things and they get sidetracked. And though we may say Krishna, we may think of Krishna as completely different from what he is, and then we get a different goal. We think of Krishna as a material entity, and we get a material goal. We don't get Krishna. Mayavadi Shan Hare Krishna. They don't get Krishna. They think of Krishna as material, so they don't get Krishna. So how we think of Krishna is also important. Okay, Hare Krishna.